Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Gary. Let's hope this goes. We're by a blazing freeway and a loud river with terrible internet.
We're near Akron, Ohio, and we've been on the road for over a week now.
It is,
and
over a week.
In America. And yeah. It's going really well.
Yeah, and today...
Well, hang on, because I saw the President of the United States yesterday.
You did? Yes, you did, in Washington. Yes, you did.
3 yards away from me. I was just walking around in Washington, as were you. In fact, you were running in Washington.
I was.
Not running for president, just running for fun. And I just walked around and I saw they closed the road and I just stood on the corner there. You can see it on my Instagram if you look. And along came the cavalcade. What do you call it? The motorcade.
The motorcade,
they don't have horses now, do they? And just so many people riding bikes and cars and, you know, to bring this guy to work. It was quite extraordinary. Anyway, today, Chris Bedding, tell us more, Guy.
Chris Bedding. Well, Chris is my dear old pal. I've worked with Chris for many years, mainly with Roxy Music, with Brian Ferry, and I've been in his band, which was a great little trio of Chris, myself, and Andy Newmark. We've done all sorts of funny little gigs and played for other artists. Yeah. Chris is just, he's the ultimate journeyman, but he's also very much his own man. I mean, he's one of those people, he's like a Zelig. He was everywhere, moment.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, in the 70s, I thought he was the coolest guitarist, you know. He, you know, after Mick Ronson, really, you know, I sort of got to know, you know, obviously they had the motorbiking track that he brought out as a solo record, which I bought. And then it was really his work with Brian Ferry on the Let's Stick Together and In Your Mind, where you saw him as, you know, with that great quiff that he has and looking super cool.
First 50s. Leather trousers I ever saw, I think.
I mean, he's played with Elton John, Harry Nilsson, Joan Armour Trading, and of course he produced the early demos for the Sex Pistols, hung out with all that those guys, with Malcolm McLaren, and he played with Nick Mason.
And he played with Nick Mason, yeah, with Carla Bley. Yeah, let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rockonteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rockonteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hey, there he is.
Chris.
Hello,
oh, my
mate.
God. He's still got the hair. I'm so envious of that hair.
I've always hated you for that, Chris. Mine has receded, yours always stayed.
I've been envious of that hair since I was 15 years old.
Well, nice to see you both.
No, good to see you, Chris. It's been a long time, mate.
Yes, it has.
Where are you, Chris?
I'm in West Sussex.
Because, of course, we both lived in Brighton for a while. We were neighbours in Brighton.
We lived on the same block, didn't we, for a while?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So what are you up to, Chris?
Well, not a great deal. Not a great deal. It's been a funny couple of years.
Oh, you think?
I did the War of the Worlds thing. A little tour.
That's right.
They tour every sort of 2 years, 18 months. They keep doing, it's one of those things, they keep doing farewell tours.
We're on tour right now with Nick Mason.
That's right.
This is what we've been doing.
Right, so, how's that?
It might be a nice in to begin with your... Yeah. You actually did Nick's first solo record, didn't you?
I did. Fictitious Sports was the album, and I did it around 1980, which I just realised is over 40 years ago. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah. Was that before Carla Bley then? Sorry, I've got this.
No, Carla Bley was on Fictitious Sports. She was doing a lot of the writing.
I thought that was a separate thing.
Well, it might have been later on, but this was maybe, I don't know how that all came about, but there they were. I got the call to go up to Woodstock where she had a studio and nice setup. There was Steve Swallow on the bass, who was very good, and and it was all right. You know, it's a bit prog, but don't mind a bit of prog now and then.
Because you once sort of came second in some jazz guitarist poll, and you're saying you like a bit of prog. So, because we, you know, I always think of you as this fabulously proto-punk guitarist. You're the sort of so true to the essence of rock and roll.
Oh, yeah, just blown my cool, haven't I?
We all have, yeah. We're playing prog out here, mate. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, Nick's your man for all that. Yeah.
Chris, the first time I sort of really became aware of you was probably on the Let's Stick Together track and that video, you know, and how cool you looked on that. And that whole album, it's quite a weird album, Brian's album, because it's only like a couple of years after Country Life, and yet there's versions of Casanova, which actually I think some of those versions of the old Roxy tracks that he does on there are better than the originals in some cases.
Right.
It was a weird concept that he put together.
It was one of those albums that we did it as a EP, and I don't think it was ever issued as the Let's Stick Together album in England.
And that's right. Yeah, it was. Yeah, of course.
It was.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a mishmash stylistically of tracks, was put together by his, probably without his approval, because it was Let's Stick Together was on an EP with other tracks.
But he was redoing some old Roxy stuff that was only a couple of years old.
I'm not on the whole album of the Let's Stick Together album. I'm on this EP.
Oh, I gotcha.
And I did the four tracks from the EP, so it's all a bit of an odd period.
But how did you become Brian's sort of right-hand man?
Well, I was in a band called Sharks in the early 70s.
Yes.
And we were...
Andy Fraser,
yeah. And our first outing was supporting Roxy Music on their second tour. So we got to know the guys. We got to know Andy Mackay and Phil Manzanera, and I suppose we... Brian's not one of those guys who's that sort of gregarious, but we knew of him and he knew of us, basically. So I guess that's how it all came about, and I got a call a bit later on. Oh, no, at the same time, I think when the Sharks broke up, I was kind of managed by EG, Mark Fenwick, and all those people.
Who managed Roxy.
So we were kind of in the same ballpark, really. So it was inevitable that we were going to end up working together, which we did, and it was quite... productive, I think.
I think the quiff
is this where your association with Chris? Oh, sorry, I was going to say, because I can't remember who produced the Brian stuff. Is Chris Thomas involved here?
Yes, Chris Thomas produced,
because that's what became an incredibly important relationship for you.
It did, yeah. Chris Thomas produced Let's Stick Together, and I had already worked with Chris Thomas with John Cale, so I knew Chris Thomas. There's this really odd situation where Chris Thomas was already recognised as a great producer. He was on the road in John Cale's road band playing keyboards, second keyboards, with John Cale.
Oh, right.
And we were on the album that was Slow Dazzle, it was called, for Ireland. We were all set to do Helen of Troy album, and you'd have thought, who shall I get to produce it? Of course, it's going to be Chris Thomas, isn't it? But he didn't ask him. So we were all... I mean, Chris Thomas would have been perfect. He was familiar with the material. He loved John. Chris loved John. And but John had one of those moments where, I'm not going to ask the obvious, talented guy that I know really well who'd be dying to do it. I won't ask him. So I guess that's a question for John Cale to answer. I mean, I've always wondered why, because it was a bit chaotic, because John's a bit chaotic when he produces his own stuff, and it would have been so much more of a polished album than Helen of Troy.
Yeah, but he may never have gone on to produce the Sex Pistols as well, you know, and...
That was years later.
The fact that he ended up going on and doing working with you and Brian, you know, just sent him off into a different path.
It might have done, because I kind of introduced him to the Sex Pistols.
That's right.
And when I did my album, the Hurt album, around the same time that the Sex Pistols were doing their Nevermind the Bollocks album, I got in as a backing singer, none other than Chrissie Hynde, who who'd not been known, wasn't known at all, and hadn't got a Pretenders band together. So I introduced Chris and Chrissy together. So a lot of those things might not have happened if I'd have, yeah.
Have you seen Pistol, the TV show?
I've seen some of it. I wasn't able to finish it. I thought I was a bit grossed out by it because, you know, it's one of those things where you'll know this, when you're present during sort of momentous happenings in the music business, you know, you've got your version of what went on. And I was present during lots of situations and lots of gigs, early gigs, and ended up producing their demos and introducing them to Chris Thomas. And so I've got my version of what went down, and I'm sort of looking, everybody's written a book or like got an opinion from those guys. You know? And I'm going, wait a minute, that's not what happened. You
know? Yeah. So, are there any key points you can think? Is there anything that sticks in your mind? Anything in particular? I mean, for a start, you should be in it. It's true. You're such a key player. You are definitely a missing member of that story.
There is a bit where you're kind of in it, isn't there? As a guy who's kind of helping out with some demos?
That's Dave Goodman. That's the other guy. I was the guy that got them in the studio first. They'd never been in a studio before. And then they went off with this other guy who was a bit of a hippie, who thought the way to produce a rock band was to have them play their backing tracks over and over and over again until they got really tired of it. I just went in and I took their first date, and everything was really easy because they were a band who knew all their songs. They didn't have to learn any songs, they knew them all. And I chose the best songs and we went first date. And I didn't want them to get like red light fever. You know, I said, let's just run one song down, you know. And I told the engineer, I said, just record it. And it, of course, they didn't make any mistakes. It was fantastic. That was the first take. They thought that was me being
lazy,
a bit lazy, or like lackadaisical, or like not, you know. But I knew enough about playing in the studio at that point. You know, this was about 1976, to know that that's the way you did it. They went off and thought, oh, we don't want spreading. He didn't take it seriously enough, and they went off with Dave Goodman, this hippie who thought that you needed to go on playing the same old thing over and over and over again until it lost all its life.
But didn't Malcolm want us? I remember you saying once there was a guitar style or sound that you were after, and Malcolm wanted something different. I can't remember what it was you said.
Don't remember that, because I bought along my amp for Steve Jones, so he kind of sounded a bit like me anyway. So no wonder people thought it was me.
Didn't he used to play a Fender, didn't he?
Yeah, I think they used Fender Twins, which I never got a good sound out of mine.
So you don't like Twins? You don't like Fender Twins, do you?
Well, they're too heavy and they're too loud. I turn all the treble and bass off and just use the mid.
But, you know, I as regular listeners to this show...
Can we just say on record, we've just had a legendary guitarist complaining that an amp is too loud.
Well, if you're playing clubs, it's too loud.
Chris, as regular listeners to this show know, I saw the Sex Pistols at Screen of the Green with Glenn Matlock in that first, and it did change my life. But the one thing that always surprised me when people spoke about punk was that they apparently couldn't play. But what I saw was a band that really could play.
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah.
Steve was a good player, and the whole rhythm section was fantastic with Glenn.
Steve is a great player. Yes. Cookie has a fantastic pocket.
Yes.
I've always said he's one of the great. He's a great drummer.
Yeah. The Sex Pistols were like, I think, the only punk band from that time that I really liked. I didn't get suddenly overwhelmed with punk and get into it. I thought, well, these guys are good. You know, I thought they could play. And I thought Steve Jones was amazing because apparently he'd only been playing a couple of years. And I thought, and I'd been playing for yonks. And I thought, well, for that type of music, Steve plays it perfectly, and I couldn't play it any better for all my experience and, you know, sort of background in different types of music. He played it just as well as it is possible to play that music.
There was a rumour for years that it was you, wasn't there?
There was, yeah. And, I called up Malcolm McLaren and said, look, it's a bit tough on Steve. He probably wants to get credit for his work. Well, why don't we put together some kind of press release to officially say that it's Steve and not me, and Malcolm wasn't interested. I thought
he wants the trouble, doesn't he? He wants the intrigue.
He'd rather. And so at that point, I stopped having anything to do with Malcolm. No, but I totally get. It's a bit too weird.
I totally get why you were involved, because, I mean, if anyone looks at pictures of you in the 70s, you were one of the coolest people I've ever seen in rock. And so I guess you were, and there was this kind of 50s revival going on at that time, which Malcolm was also part of with Let It Rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And so were you part of that whole scene?
Yeah, well, because I remember you telling me Vivian used to make all your clothes for you.
Well, she made some. Before
then, she used to make all your peg pants.
Yeah, she did. I used to go there and get clothes, because she couldn't get new stuff that looked like that. You had to go to a vintage store and get something that's a bit ratty. She would make something brand new and it would be good. So they...
There's no such thing as vintage then. It was second hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So I used to go there. So they knew about me and they persuaded me to come down to see the band at the 100 Club. And it was Chrissy Hynes that called me up and said, you've got to come and see this band at the 100 Club tonight. And there we go.
What was it like?
Oh, it was great. I thought I was very impressed with them. There was not many people in the club. And there were even less people in the club when they'd finished. They sort of frightened people off. So that kind of...
But this is what's really nice and really refreshing to hear from you, Chris, is that this whole thing around the Sex Pistols is everyone just saying, they were dreadful and they made me think, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And they're awful. And what's really nice is to hear like a proper, real musician like yourself who has actually thought, you know, your love for them was based on the fact that they were actually a really good band.
Yeah, they were a good band. And we knew it. I knew at the time, being involved in the music business, that we needed something new. These Sex Pistols were exactly what we needed. Because, you know, the Melody Maker and the New Musical Express, it was like ELP, Led Zeppelin and ELO and all that sort of stuff. We were getting a bit tired. And I thought we needed something new, and there they were. And I couldn't believe that I used to go down the speakeasy and these musical journalists used to seriously say to me, you better watch who you hang out with, because you've got a good reputation in this business and you shouldn't be hanging out with guys like Sex Pistols. So I would say, well, that's interesting, each to his own. When did you hear them? Oh, I've not heard them, but everybody knows they're terrible. So I thought, well, I can do something here. So I went back to Malcolm and said, if you hire a studio for a day, I can give you, because nobody with that reputation, no record executives are going to come around the 100 Club to listen to you. They're not going to be interested. They've got to hear something. You know, it's the old three-song demo, which will get you a deal, which you've got many people deals over the years. So I said, I can do that for you because I know how to do it. So there's a bit of a funny show business type story behind that. We hired Majestic Studios in Clapham, which I knew from... I knew from working with Eno there, he did his Here Come the Warm Jets there. And
Throw that in.
Yeah,
just,
that's how I knew the... Casually. I'd drop that name since we're talking about...
Yeah.
That's how we got to know him on that same tour. Eno was still in the back. It was his last tour with Roxy. So I thought, this guy's a bit cheesy, this Malcolm McLaren. I'm not going to get ripped off by him. So I said, Malcolm, it's about £18 an hour. You're going to be in there all day. Bring enough cash because I'm not going to get stuck with the bill, right? So he was good as gold. The guys showed up. We were all set up by 11 o'clock in the morning. By the time of 5 o'clock come around, we got three songs all mixed and everything.
What tracks did you do?
I went to a rehearsal and got them to do their whole repertoire, and I chose at that time Problems, No Feelings, and Pretty Vacant. They're not written God Save the Queen at that point, otherwise I'd probably been in. So I said, those are your three strongest songs, and that's what we did. They sometimes appear, those songs, as the spedding tapes on the reissues of Nevermind the Bollocks.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so... The irony of all this is that I thought I was being so smart with Malcolm McLaren, but if I'd have paid for those sessions, I'd have owned the masters.
Oh.
So who knows? Later on, I realised my...
That could be your ticket out of here.
So I thought that was pretty funny.
Because it's funny, because everyone who formed a punk band after that, and including, you know, myself, that, you know, I saw them in August. By September, I had, you know, my equivalent of a punk band.
thought they had to play at 100 miles an hour. But if you listen to Nevermind the Bollocks, it's not 100 miles an hour.
No, they've all got good grooves, yeah. And that's one of the things that I didn't like about a lot of the punk
things. They played at Who speed.
Yeah, they did.
Who speed, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
And at that time, I was like totally listening to Otis Redding and Motown and that type of American R&B from the 70s. And so I was quite impressed with the Sex Pistols' groove and totally nonplussed by the Ramones, who played everything far too fast. Even though they made it a thing, that was their thing, wasn't it? But I thought, well, you know, I don't choose particularly to listen to that type of music. You know, I much prefer what the Sex Pistols were doing, which for young guys was quite mature.
Which I suppose was more like Iggy Pop and Chris having his band, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry?
We also say, because having played with you, having played in your band, you know, with Andy Newmark, which is, I've got to say, one of the most fun trio things I've ever done, is that because you're natural for someone with such facility. I mean, the songs that I've done with you, Garland Jeffries, Wild in the Streets and stuff, it is that real kind of no messing, straight down the line kind of proto-punk that you like, isn't it, when you're left to your own devices?
It's a bit...
Like your Robert Gordon stuff, the most...
Yeah. Yeah,
truthful, you know.
Yeah, I like to try and strip it all down to the what really works with no frills. Yeah, and then Sex Pistols were doing that. They did that.
But I suppose what Guy's saying as well, and what I know your sound for, was that sort of slightly 50s, you know, the sort of Eddie Cochran influence, the rockabilly influence, music.
Yeah, yeah. But
is that so? How did you get into that sound? How did that become Chris Spedding?
Well, when I was about 12 years old, that takes you to about 1956. And that was when Elvis, Little Richard, and that's when all that was happening, which we now call rock and roll or rockabilly. We never used to call it rockabilly in those days. It was just rock and roll.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, rockabilly, I don't think I ever heard till like the end of the 70s.
I know. Well, when I first met Robert Gordon in New York, he said, well, I hope you can play this rockabilly stuff, Chris. And I said, well, what do you mean? You know, like Elvis and Gene Vincent. Oh, Scotty Moore and I know how to do that shit. Because I grew up on it. All the first things that I ever picked up a guitar and tried to sort of copy guitar parts was Elvis's guitar player, who, of course, I didn't know what his name. We didn't know any of those guys' names. We didn't know that it was James Burton with Rick Nelson, or was a guy with Gene Vincent. Cliff Gallup.
What's his name? Amazing. Cliff Gallup. Yeah.
We didn't know any of those guys. We thought the guys that backed up Elvis were called the Jordanaires, which, of course, because that was Elvis Presley with the Jordanaires on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, the guitar player's got to be probably his name is Jordan. You know, much later we get to find out all the details of this stuff. But if you're 12 years old, you don't know. You're just going by the record. Information on the record sleeve, which was...
But did that encourage you to go out and buy a guitar, or did you get bought a guitar?
Well, I started out in music playing the violin when I was 9 years old, but I didn't know any better. All my parents were into classical music, and I didn't know anything. I mean, they wouldn't even play Frank Sinatra and Rosemary Clooney in the house. It was all like opera and everything, and that's what I thought music was. And when I started hearing, it was the skiffle thing. You remember skiffle?
Yeah. Of course, my dad wrote Tommy Steele's songs.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, rock with the caveman.
Indeed.
You know, Glenn Matlock's a big fan of all that stuff.
I know he is. I've actually played rock with the caveman with Glenn.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's always champion. He's been a big champion of that.
Yeah, yeah.
God bless him.
He's into all that. Yeah. So that's how I came to be a guitar player. Giving up the violin, putting it away, and much to the disgust of my parents, because in 1956, if you wanted to play rock and roll, it was equivalent if you wanted to be a gangster rapper now. It was a bit weird. Yeah. It's a bit like, oh dear, we're a bit worried about Chris, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were right to be.
I guess they were, yeah.
Was Bill Haley too naff in those days? Because I know my parents went to see Bill Haley.
Right. Well, no. Well, we thought Bill Haley was great until we became aware of Elvis, because Bill Haley looked like your uncle. or your dad.
That's right, he was 36, which is kind of unimaginably old.
36 stone, I think he was.
Well, you look at pictures of him now and he doesn't look that naff.
No. No, of course not. We're all twice as old as why.
I know, not to us now, no. But he had a shit-up band, really hot band.
Right.
And that guitar player who played the Rock Around the Clock solo, I still love to play that. What's his name? I've forgotten his name now. I did look up who he was. He died shortly after cutting that solo.
It's really fast jazzy.
It was like what you might call a Western swing player. There's a genre called Western swing, which was almost jazz, but it was country sort of flavor. But they were all jazz players. And so he was one of those. He's had the chops of a bebop jazz player.
His name, I just looked him up. His name was Danny Cedron.
Cedron, yes, right. Danny Cedron, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guitar that he was using was just a regular archtop guitar with a Diarmond pickup screwed on it, with no cutaway. It's a regular archtop guitar.
So when did you get your first... Where did you get your first guitar?
Well, I got my dad to get me one. It was a Fender... not Fender, Hofner Senator. And it was similar to what Danny Cedron was playing. It had no cutaway and it had one pickup. And I thought it was wonderful at the time. And a Watkins amplifier.
Of course.
17 watts. And I was totally bowled over by the fact that he had a tremolo on it so I could sound like Dewey and Eddie.
Fantastic. Did it ever occur to you to turn it up and drive it? Was drive something you'd avoid?
No, I thought that... Well, you see, my amplifier, when I got my first school group together, it was not loud enough. We got this bass player in who had a Watkins Dominator.
Oh.
We had about four inputs. So we all plugged into that, including...
They're still small. They're still very small, the Dominator. That was my first
amp. Not to us in those days. Yeah. Everybody went in it, including the bass player and the singer. It must have sounded dreadful.
How? It hasn't got the inputs. How did you do that? Did you just sort of splice leads together or something?
We managed. I thought it had four inputs.
Must have had four inputs, yeah.
PM,
yeah.
Yeah. Or one marked accordion. Remember those?
Well, he was an accordion player, wasn't he? Charlie Watkins, who started Wem, was an accordion player. He hated rock and roll.
Right.
He basically wanted to amplify accordions.
Okay. So what was the moment, Chris, when you sort of thought, this is it, I'm going to become professional? How did that happen?
I think it was because I was so bad at everything else at school. I sort of was a bit of a dropout. I used to bring my guitar into school and mess around in free periods. And I wasn't interested in anything else. I wasn't interested in academia or doing anything respectable, basically. I wanted to be a teddy boy.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't afford the clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
But I've been working on the Elvis hairdo for the last 50 years.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You and Jimmy Page were the sort of two go-to guys in for session rock music.
Well, it was Jimmy Page in the 60s. Yeah, I was a bit of a late starter then. I was going through my jazz purist phase. And I really wasn't doing sessions.
I still find that really hard to imagine, but I love that. I find that extraordinary. So, you know, knowing you as I've known you for what, over 20 years, and the jazz. I love that you have that side to you. But here's the thing, Chris. So you leave school, you come to London, right?
Yeah.
In search of fame, fortune. How did you eat? How did you live? What did you do? You know, when you got to London.
Oh, I got a job at Clifford Essex, which is a guitar, banjo and mandolin store. They didn't specialise in amplifiers or electric instruments. It was like more for the folkies and all the old-fashioned banjo guys. And I sold sheet music there and guitars for a pittance. I think I got about 30 shillings a week or something. And then in the end, I got a job on the boats. I got a job on the P&O orchestras. Doing this trip to Australia and back. That was in the days when you could pay £10 and have an assisted trip to Australia because they wanted people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My uncle and aunt.
Poms.
Left.
£10 poms.
£10 poms, yeah. And that was my first professional job. I came back to London and picked up a gig playing with Nat Temple's orchestra, who used to do the society circuit. We'd do like bar mitzvahs and weddings at the Dorchester and the Savoy.
Did you wear black tie for the gig?
Oh yeah, you had to have the black tie and the tux, and we had put little band jackets on. It was pretty horrific. It's just, I mean, that fortunately these bands don't exist anymore. You just hire a DJ if you've got a function.
Yeah.
But in those days, the bands
or Brian Ferry if it's a posh function.
Yeah, and even he'd bring his DJ along.
Tape.
There was a remnants of the big bands, you know, like the Glenn Miller type, Duke.
Joe Loss.
Joe Loss made a pretty good go of it, actually.
But
Nat Temple's band, he had the sax players and the trumpet players in the front line. So you can imagine if like a 1960s pop song like from the Kinks or the Who or the Beatles, they were trying to play this. In those days, you go down Denmark Street and they give you the sheet music to the latest pops. Can you imagine what those horns would have sounded like? playing the top vocal line of like My Generation.
Oh, so they're instrumental. My God.
It was horrific. But anyway, that was my grounding in like learning the business. That was my gig.
You must have taught yourself to read music for that.
Well, the violin period meant that I knew what the notes were.
Of course, you played the violin. We skipped that. You started, of course, the violin.
I played the violin, so I knew what the notes were. So I wasn't a total ignoramus. So I was able to, if I was in a situation where notes were involved, I wasn't freaking out, thinking I can't do this. I was thinking, well, I know what these notes are. I wonder what this is going to sound like.
You ended up in this band, Battered Ornaments, that supported the Rolling Stones at Hyde Park.
We were managed by Blackhill Enterprises, who promoted the whole thing, so they put their band on in the prime spot. So that's the other little...
And how had you got to be managed by Blackhill Enterprises? Because they were a big deal.
Well, it was Pete Brown's band.
That's Pete Brown, right, of course. The lyricist.
The lyricist from The Cream, which is how I got to do the Jack Bruce albums.
Oh.
I always reckon he needed a guitar player who didn't sound like, or was trying to sound like Eric Clapton, because he'd already done that. And I was somebody who didn't sound like Eric Clapton. I never really said to Jack, is this why you asked me? Because he's not around to ask anymore.
I think it probably was. I mean, because you're right, because there was that whole period. There was only Clapton, wasn't there?
There were very, very few guitar players that you could hire that didn't want to sound like him, especially if you were playing with Jack Bruce.
Yeah, although actually on an aside, there's something, because there's a record of yours that I always loved, and I remember I've talked to you about this, which is Guitar Jamboree,
right,
where you do that thing of where you imitate you name every guitarist and imitate them, but it was interesting when I was asking about the style, because you said that, so like for instance when you do the Pete Townsend bit, it's very hard to do something without infringing into
the copyright
territory, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very careful to avoid.
You can't do anything that's too recognisable.
Right.
But you said about the Clapton one was hardest because it's actually all Albert King.
Well, yeah, one of Eric Clapton's best solos is Strange Brew, which is exactly the same as Eric as an Albert King solo on Born Under a Bad Sign. I believe that's is exactly the same. So
I guess you know, you were coming from a slightly different angle, weren't you? Your musical inspirations were different to his, I suppose.
I was listening to a lot of those guys and Guitar Jamboree. I was genuinely listening to them and being influenced by them.
Oh no, it's a real love letter of a record. I mean, that's what I love. I remember just hearing it. It was John Peel played it one night, and it's just stayed with me forever. I loved it.
Well, you know, we see festivals all the time now on TV, and they're, you know, the BBC are doing Glastonbury, you know, and it's such a corporate thing now. But what feeling of, was there some sense of revolution when you're playing Hyde Park in 1969 or whenever it was? I think it was 69. With, you know, this joyous, free concert for young people. You're taking over the world.
I was kind of intrigued to see the Rolling Stones, but I wasn't having a good day. I used to get terrible hay fever, and it was a bad day for the hay fever. And we had, being the Battered Ornaments, our bandwagon was an ex-army field ambulance with a big red cross on it. And of course, the Stones commandeered it to come in to Hyde Park with. The limos came in, and there was nobody in them. And then this horrible looking field ambulance came in, and that's where the Stones were. And they turfed me out of the, I was trying to not be affected by the pollen count of that day by secreting myself in the bandwagon. They turfed me out. No, we've got to use the van to go and get the Stones. So I was really pissed off about it. as soon as I went on stage, I went back in the van, and of course I couldn't really hear them.
Oh my God.
That's my abiding memory of the day.
Because didn't you get supplanted by Keith?
Oh well, yeah. I'd accepted a gig to do a week in the studio with Tom Waits, and I thought a week would be enough because I'd booked some gigs. I was going out on the road the week after, and I'd listened to a little bit of Tom.
Was this as you or with?
Yes, it would have been my little trio. Yeah, similar to the one that we had in New York. I'd listened to a little bit of Tom Waits, and I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. It sounds like he's really spontaneous and doing it really quick. But this album, we'll do this album in a week. But as it turned out, he wasn't that sort of guy at all. He was very sort of obsessed with every little detail. And we ended up just doing that one track in that one week. So that's why I ended up only being on one track.
Right.
I had to leave this project and go on the road.
What album was it?
Swordfish Trombone or something.
Right, I know.
Oh, no, that's the one.
Wasn't it one? That was one after Swordfish Trombones, wasn't it?
But I get why he wanted to use you, because he's got that sort of 50s throwback thing, and there's definitely,
right.
you seem like a perfect combination, you two, but the detail, like it goes against the grain of putting together a 50s sounding record.
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed in that, because I thought it would be very spontaneous and sort of lots of fun, but it was very, very...
It's more contrived.
He was a bit obsessed about every sound. You know, he had these demos that he'd made, and he wanted the percussion and the drums to be sound exactly like this cassette, which is really lo-fi. We were in the top studio, CBS in New York, I think it was. And he'd go around the studio opening drawers and banging on the bottom and picking up boxes, hitting them. He said, I want it to sound like that. You know, I thought, well, we've learned the song. We're sort of into the song now. Why can't we just do it? And, you know, can always overdub the sound that you want later. It's just spoiling the vibe here, man, you know. But I didn't say that, but that's why we only got the... That's why I'm only on the one track.
And then Keith came in and took over.
Well, I didn't know that. I mean, I found out about Keith coming in later because I was out on the road.
Was it Rain Dogs, Chris?
Rain Dogs. Yeah, Rain Dogs is the name of the album, yeah.
You Googled that, didn't you, Gary?
I don't Google anything. I've got a brain that just contains everything. You know, this is a question I want to ask you. So you've got Broken Ornaments, and we're going back now to this sort of late 60s, early 70s, and you've got your own band. Is there this dilemma always between wanting... And Guy, it's probably this question I need to ask you both in this... You know, I always wanted to be in a band. I always wanted to write in a band and be in a band, and the band was everything for me. But if I'd been drawn into session playing, I can see why that I might get frustrated. Because I'm earning good money in as a session player, as you both probably were. So, but you have to kind of give up good money to make a band work. Was you ever any regrets, Chris, that you couldn't get that thing, have your own group only?
Well, I always used to try with the groups. I tried with the Battered Ornaments, and it sort of kind of fizzled out. None of the band were... We were all a bit sort of... what's the word? When you're
poor,
well, we were poor, but we were anti everything. You know, what's the word when you're anti everything?
Punk.
Well, we kind of were for 1969.
Yeah. You didn't want to be commercial.
Yeah, we thought we were a bit like the Mothers of Invention. You know, like sending everything up and being satirical. And in actual fact, we were just a load of ex-jazzers trying to play rock and roll because we thought that's the way to make some money.
Cynical, I think that's called.
Cynical, yeah. We were, but we had the advantage of working in Abbey Road Studios in the late 60s, which was not bad. But oddly enough, the rest of the band weren't interested in continuing with it. We fired Pete Brown from the band because we didn't like his singing, then realised that none of us could sing any better than him. What happened was the band sort of fell apart around me, and I was left the only guy who wanted to make a record. So I became a singer-songwriter by default. I thought, I'm not going to walk away as a musician in his 20s, walk away from an expectation to deliver an album that's going to be recorded in Abbey Road. I thought that would be like completely bonkers. I might as well give up and, you know, take up detectoring or something. So that's the beginning of me doing a solo stuff. The band fell apart, and there was nobody left but me to sing. We'd done all the backing tracks all in all the wrong keys. I didn't even know what my key was. So I had to do the vocals on that.
But you do, because you have kind of, you've always managed to, it seems to me, Chris, you know, from all the stuff I've done with you, it's like, you know, we'll be doing stuff with Brian and then you'll have this little thing, can we go and do that? And then there'll be that little thing. It's like you're always managing to scratch that itch somehow though, aren't you?
I found when I got into doing lots of sessions, which I did around 1970, you're aware of the syndrome of, if as a session man, you know, you sort of play on somebody's album, the album becomes a big hit, and you think, oh, you know, actually I could have got a little more credit for that, or like, you know, I've just got the session fee and these guys have been buying mansions and stuff. You know. And you get a little bit bitter. Well, I never had that because I always could go to Abbey Road and if I had an idea or I had any inspiration, I could always, because they didn't used to charge us any money.
Wow.
They take it out of the royalties. You know, we didn't have to sort of say, hey, can I get a couple of grand to go in and do a day in the studio? You just go in and you'd never hear about any money. If you wanted to hire a session guy, EMI would pay for it. The guy would come down with a little...
Nice.
Because you were signed to them. Is that what you mean?
That's right. We were signed to Harvest, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. I used to show up at Abbey Road and I was able to park my car in the car park, which hardly any session guys ever...
But you played on some amazing tracks and albums in those. I mean, Harry Nilsson... Smilshen. That's easy for you to say. And but Elton John's Madman Across the Water.
Yep.
I mean, let's talk about Elton.
Let's talk about that because that's a classic.
Yes, Paul Buckmaster. It's a big orchestra. It was a big orchestra. It wasn't like the orchestra was put on later. It was all there. The Trident was just full of violin players and who were fitting in somewhere.
Where was Trident? Is that the one in Primrose Hill? Was it? Where was Trident?
No, in Soho.
St. Anne's Court.
Oh, it,
St. Anne's Court.
My brain went. Of course, that was the famous one where Visconti records the Electric Warrior and Ziggy Stardust was made. Trident. That's tiny, though. Is there an orchestra in there?
Yeah, I know. It's like a, it's like a somebody's flat.
So was Elton around?
I believe he was, yeah. I know Paul was, and the producer, Gus Dudgeon.
Did you have a freedom at that point, Chris, to come up with improvised stuff, or was it all...
No, I think that would have been all written out, that riff.
Right.
It would have been written out.
I mean, by Elton? Would that have been Elton or...
No, Paul. Paul.
Oh,
yeah.
Paul Butman, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was there with on the podium with a baton, conducting the orchestra. Yeah.
Oh, no, okay, talking of Paul's... You're McCartney, but didn't you have quite an extraordinary thing with McCartney in terms of who you were working with?
McCartney, yeah, I did. I was living in New York at the time, and I got the call to do music for his movie, Say Goodbye to Broad Street.
Give my regards to Broad Street.
I always get that wrong. Well, I didn't know much about it, but he had these songs, and Ringo was on drums. At one point, Dave Edmunds was on guitar, second guitar. And when Paul was playing the piano, he got John Paul Jones to play the bass.
Oh, my God.
And Linda was in evidence. She was very nice, taking pictures of everybody.
And wasn't it George Martin and Jeff Emerick?
Yeah. So there was a situation where we were doing this one thing. I was flown over regularly to do... You would think to do rehearsals, but actually
those are the days.
Took place in Air Studios in Oxford Circus, right? This is our rehearsal. We were there for a week. And we'd, So there were several times, and I'd be playing along the song that Paul had brought, and I was the only non-Beatle. It would be Ringo, Jeff Emerick, George Martin, Paul, and me.
Wow.
So I could be fantasizing, I'm George Harrison for the day.
But when you describe your growing up as a kid and what you're into, were the Beatles still part of that? Or were you just were they a bit too pop for you?
I'm a bit the same age as them. So when I was growing up, George was also growing up. We were kind of adult together. When I was growing up, it was Elvis and Lonnie Donegan and Little Richard and Gene Vincent, and all this went along with it, like, Frank Ifield.
Yes.
All that other stuff.
But was there still a sense of, like, the Beatles? There is still a sense, even for you, as...
Well, yes, we paid great attention to them, because there was still a feeling, especially since I was still in my sort of jazz snob time. Who are these guys? She Loves You and all this. Well, actually, these guys are actually pretty good. They can play well, they play in time, they play in tune, and they sing excellently. They know a few chords, yeah, and they can play them very well. They're excellent guitar sounds. At that time, the guitar was in a mix, you wouldn't get like bass and bass drum like you do now. That would be quite muted. What would be carrying the whole thing would be the guitar sound, George Harrison's guitar sound, really great playing.
Yeah.
Really clean playing,
When you said you were having your jazz snob period, so what's the jazz you were listening to? I'm quite interested.
Well, I liked Oscar Peterson, I liked guitar players like Jim Hall, Barney Kessel, Cal Farlow, and Grant Green.
Right. Joe Pass, or was that too...
Joe Pass came on a little later.
A little later.
I wasn't so impressed with him.
But Chris, I was listening to Nucleus earlier. Because I remember them being around when I was a kid, and a few of the sixth formers used to have Nucleus albums in the school. But that particular Elastic Rock album is amazing.
And I like that album.
Your guitar is still so you. It's not like, suddenly you're playing jazz and you're playing like a trad jazzer or a kind of, it still has that sort of bluesy sort of, even that rockabilly feel to it, and it's got soul, and I mean Elastic Rock is a fantastic track.
Well, thank you. I like that too. That was my audition doing that song. I was asked to come again. It was at Trident Studios, and I was given that song to play a solo one. They didn't have a solo on it. The band had already done the track, and I think that was my first or second take. And I can remember the only thing I was thinking, worried about, was that I parked somewhere in Soho, which you could in those days. And I was worried that my meter was running out and I had to go out and feed the meter.
I could not hear that in the solo.
No. but I have that abiding memory about that session. And I got the gig.
I love it. Two of these, I mean, I urge anyone who hasn't heard it to go and listen to Nucleus Elastic Rock. But, you know, we're talking about that track, which is a classic, and then we're talking about Hyde Park. And on your mind, in one of them is Hay Fever, and the other one is you're feeding the meter.
Yeah, that's.
But you didn't stay in that band. That wasn't your through line.
At that point, I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to get out of anything to do with jazz and get into rock. And I felt that, you see, the thing called jazz rock or jazz fusion was just starting then, and everybody in Nucleus except me was a jazzer who had not paid any attention to rock. They saw me as somebody that could legitimately get in as a rock element to make it jazz fusion, and I could relate to the jazzers because I knew the repertoire of the jazz musician. And so I got a lot of work. I got work with Mike Gibb's band, Mike Westbrook's band, all the jazzers that were around at that time who wanted to make it into the new jazz fusion sort of fad. So I was a bit fed up with that. So, well, why can't I just play some rock and roll now? I'd like to want to do that now. So that's what I did.
You didn't play on the Hapsash and the Coloured Coat album, did you? Were you on that second UFO album?
I don't recall that.
Because we had Mike Batt on.
We had Mike Batt on. Of course, another long association of yours.
Yeah,
I have to say it, Chris, but you became a Womble briefly, didn't you?
I did become a Womble, yeah. Well, there was all session
guys. Sex Pistol to Womble in kind of within an incredibly short space of time. That's kind of
yeah, it was all going on at the same time.
Which Womble had the quiff? I can't remember.
I was Wellington with the Flying V.
Feel about that?
Well, it kind of crept up on me, really. We were all session guys. It was like Les Hurdle on the bass and Clem Cattini on the drums and Ray Cooper on the tambourine. And we were all session guys. We weren't really Wombles. It was all Mike Batt's vocals, all his compositions. We were just tired, you know. But
it's very funny, isn't it, that the Wombles, you know, with all the names you just reeled off, was actually a really posh band.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was very resourceful of Mike to sort of pull all those different styles. Wombling this, Wombling Merry Christmas, in the Hall of the Mountain Womble, you know, all that stuff.
He got you in a suit.
Well, he did, you know, because there was, I don't know whether it's still the case, but if you...
Did you have Vivian Westwood make yours?
No. It was Mike's mum.
Yeah, yeah.
In those days, I think it still might happen. If you got on Top of the Pops, you're supposed to redo your track.
I remember doing that. Going in, you pretend to record the single.
Going to that, the most popular place was that place, Redan Recorders, behind Queensway, because they had no window between the control room and the studio. So that what they do is they just get the tape in, pull all the faders down, and they send you in one at a time. And they go, okay, guy, go and do the bass. And you just go and stand in the control room, and they'd lift and they'd bring up the bass fader.
With the original tracker.
Right, done it. Yeah.
Because he had a musician's union guy making sure that you did it. They used to fool him. They used to take him for a drink at the time, and they swap the tapes around.
Yeah, because you weren't allowed to mime on TV with your original track, because that would put session players who may have played on the track out of work. Right. Yeah.
Well, if you're a Womble, you had to mime because they had no mouths.
If you're a Womble, you had to mime because, frankly, you're a fucking Womble. Yeah.
No, but the my point in bringing this up was that the musicians' union said that the rule was you had to ask the original guys to do the Top of the Pops track.
Yeah.
And nobody took any notice of that because none of the session guys were interested in doing like a last minute thing of something they'd already done. But Mike did call me up and said, are you free to come over and jump about in a Womble suit? And I thought, it might be a fun thing to do. So I said, okay, let's do it. So that's how I became a Womble. No other reason, really. Because none of the others, like Ray Cooper or Clem Kittine, none of those guys did it.
But did the tapes get swapped in the end for Mike's original recording?
Yeah. He didn't redo them.
I mean, obviously, one of the early introductions I knew of, and I still have the record, is Motorbiking, which was a fantastic sort of pre-punk kind of rock record, wasn't it?
It's still one of the greatest honours of my life is that you played that at my 50th birthday.
I did. Well, I remember doing that.
Great guitar part. Down. Yeah, I mean, how did the whole thing come about with you getting that record out?
I knew Mickey Most from my session years. I did an album with Donovan, so I knew Mickey. I did The Sharks, which was kind of fizzled out because it wasn't a success. So I was left with something with my next thing to do. So I sort of thought to myself, this is 1975. I looked at the Melody Maker charts and I thought, what's missing from here? What does this chart need? I don't particularly like any of these songs. And I thought back to my Elvis, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran era, and I thought, well, you need something like that, because there's nothing like that. So I wrote this. I wrote the song Motorbiking. And I remember driving around London with the acoustic guitar in the back of the car, and I thought, I'm going to go and see Mickey Most. So I drove up to his office and played him the song. And he said, it was like out of a Hollywood movie. He had his feet up on the desk, smoking a cigar, and he said, that's going to be a hit.
but Chris, when you say you played it to him, did you play him a demo, or did you actually play him on guitar?
No, I played him what I had on the acoustic guitar.
Amazing.
But Mickey Most is one of those, he's got an imagination, he's got an ear, and he's got
exactly.
You don't need to have a demo. But
why, Chris, why in the poster and sleeve are you leaning against a car?
Oh, that was all done afterwards.
A lovely 50s American cast. It's the right ethos, but it's still a car. But also, one thing, Chris, is because your follow-up, which I've played with you, which was the gunfight one.
A Jump in My Car was the follow-up.
Was it the record? You know, there was that full-on, ricochet thing, Western Star, which was brilliant, it was a retro record then, but actually incredibly ahead of its time. If you know what I mean, because that would have set the world on fire if that had been years later. What was it called?
Gunfight. You talking about
Gunfight? Called Gunfight.
Yeah.
Brilliant Western sort of Dick Dale almost style kind of.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of doing any sort of spaghetti Western type of
spaghetti
thing.
Spaghetti Western. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think you'd started to find who you were and why people wanted Chris Spedding on the record? Because I know as a fan when I was a kid, you know, your style on sort of some tracks like Tokyo Joe and Let's Stick Together and Motorbiking, there was definitely the sound of Chris Spedding, and you must have then realised why people wanted you on your on their records.
I think so. After the Motorbiking thing came out, and after The Sharks, I'd made myself into a proper rock guitar player in The Sharks, because we went out and did proper rock gigs. That was one good thing that came out of it. I knew what people wanted in that era. They basically wanted overdriven rhythm guitar. That was the ethos in the mid-70s.
With a slight retro 50s sound as well, right?
Yeah.
You're a very Gibson-sounding guy, aren't you? I know you've played, when I've played with you, you've always played Troussards. But.
Yeah, the humbucking pickup, yeah. I do like. I think it's important to have like a Stratocaster or a Telecaster as well.
It's funny, Chris, because you're the one guitarist I find it really hard to associate with a Stratocaster. Telly, absolutely. You just don't strike me as a Strat guy at all.
Well, sometimes there's a sound, a delicacy of sound that you can't get out of the Gibson, and then you turn to the Stratocaster to get that in the studio. You know, I very rarely play it live.
I don't think I've ever seen you play one.
You ended up working a lot with Robert Gordon, who probably is a bigger quiff than you, right?
He's more into the 50s thing. Yeah, that's his thing.
I mean, that seemed like a marriage made in heaven, didn't it? That you and him together.
I thought. Well, I'd never rated myself as a singer. I've got about a four-note range, which influences the type of melodies that I write for myself. and I thought, here we are with a guy who can really sing. I'm a guy who writes but doesn't want to sing, and I play the guitar, Robert doesn't. So yeah, when I first met him, I thought this will be really good for both of us.
Because it's a kind of art rockabilly, isn't it, really, I suppose?
It's become a bit of a schlucky thing with lots of people doing it badly, but Robert did it really well with Link Wray in the early days, and so did the Stray Cats when they did their first records.
Yeah.
But it's a bit similar to the punk thing. Like people imitated the genre, but not always that well, as good as the first guys that did it. Same with skiffle. Not everybody was as good as Lonnie Donegan.
Yeah. How was it being on the road, Guy, with Chris? Because you went out with Roxy Chris, Music together in the early 2000s.
With Roxy Music and with Brian Ferry. We've toured a lot. I've also done a lot of solo stuff with Chris. I mean, we had a lovely trio, you, me and Andy Newmark. We also worked for a Swiss singer together. I've got to say, Chris, you get the credit as well for getting me to do possibly the weirdest gig I've ever done in my life, which is where you had this guy, and very well paid, if I don't mind saying, which was a Dutch guy who's a huge fan of yours, who had a chain of women's wear shops, and we went and played in his garden.
That's right.
For a party of his.
Yes.
It was and Andy Newmark.
He hired lights and a stage and everything.
And it was one of the funniest things, because late that night after we'd played, I said to this guy, he's a really nice guy, I said, this is amazing, but this is, you know, really, really lavish. How do you get to do this? He said, well, unlike all my friends, I don't ski. And because I don't have the expense of taking my family skiing, I can have Chris Spedding play at my party.
I didn't know that. Yeah. He used to grab us whenever we did a European tour. Were we doing a European tour, or was it a one-off?
It was we were doing other stuff in Switzerland.
Other stuff, yeah.
With Natalie, yeah. So yeah, we just popped up. Yeah, no, we didn't go. We didn't travel specially. Also, Gary should point out that Chris has a Japanese fan who follows him everywhere.
Yes,
this guy structures all his holidays around Chris's tours. Everything. I've never been out anywhere without this guy showing up somewhere.
Wow.
Yes.
We've all got one of those.
I can't remember. So I feel very rude not knowing his name, actually.
His name's Toshio, and he'll probably see this, so give him a due.
Yeah, Toshio, he's a very, very sweet man. Very sweet
Chris,
man.
Chris, it's been an honour talking to you. We're going to have to make our way.
Okay, it's been fun.
We're in Akron, and we've got a gig tonight, haven't we?
We have got a gig, in Akron, for birthplace of your old friend Chrissy Hines,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Extraordinary.
And in fact, and I've just realised I'm wearing a Vivienne Westwood top in honour of you.
Do you know what the story?
Really?
I know you've got you had a funny story about, just looking back to Sex Pistols briefly before we go, about when, didn't it, never mind the bollocks, come out in China?
Oh yes.
The Chinese.
They translated it into Chinese, and then when you translated it back, it said, take no notice of the rude word.
Never mind.
So never mind is take no notice. The bollocks, the rude word.
Which completely defeats the object of the title.
Yes, it does, yeah. Yeah.
But it also makes complete sense.
It does, yeah. Yeah. Of course it does.
I just want to direct people to what I thought I think it's a really fantastic solo album of yours called Joyland, which you've got Johnny Marr is on, and Glenn Matlock is on, and who else is on Joyland? You've got some great co-players.
One of the last things Andy Fraser did before he died. Yeah. He played bass on one of the tracks.
It's a great album.
And Arthur Brown is singing on it.
Fantastic.
Who's just released a version of Lucifer Sam, a song that we play.
Oh, okay.
An old Floyd record.
He's still sounding great, Arthur. Still got the same range. Yeah.
Chris, lovely to see you,
thank
mate.
You, bud.
See you when I get home. All the very best to you, man. Cheers.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. Good luck. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Cheers, mate.
Oh, that was a pleasure talking to him.
Lovely place. Yeah, lovely man. Lovely man.
Pinching my teenage self to speak to the great Chris Spedding. And, you know, any all those records we mentioned, you have to go out and have a listen. But have a listen to Guy Elastic Rock, Nucleus.
No, I did. It is fantastic. I know, but you're right. I haven't listened for a long time. But he's one of those people, whoever you are listening to this, you've got a record that he's on.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them. We are still keeping this going from the States. We've got some other names in our diary, haven't we, in the next
few
weeks.
We have got to say, we're fighting against time zone differences and bad Wi-Fi.
I know, I had to change room halfway through this to get my Wi-Fi. All right, thank you
but
for listening.
There's nothing we won't do to bring you your rock on tours.
Yes, thank you to our producer, Ben Jones, and Stu, who's working it today. And it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.